Hello there, and welcome to today's episode of the Easy EdTech Podcast. If we haven't met before, my name is Monica Burns. I'm a former New York City public school teacher, and I've been out of the classroom for a few years, leading professional development for educators and writing about all things EdTech on my blog, classtechtips.com. This year, we're celebrating the 10th anniversary of the blog, and there are a lot of exciting things in the works. From new music here on the podcast to a new look on the website, I can't wait to share everything with you. Before we jump into today's episode, a quick reminder. You can head to my website, classtechtips.com/podcast, for all of the show notes and resources from today's episode. And if you're listening to this episode on a podcast player like Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Google Podcasts, you should see a link in the description that you can click on as you listen today, and it will take you to all of the resources I mentioned. This episode is sponsored by Lenovo EDU, the free online student community of Lenovo. Lenovo EDU supports students preparing for a future career, as well as providing resources and guidance for parents and guardians to support their students' passions. Join the community today for special discounts, laptop giveaways, free classes, and scholarships. Don't forget to check out some exclusive blog posts I put together for them. Head over to education.lenovo.com to sign up for free. Today's episode is titled Using Graphic Novels to Teach High-Level Thinking with Shavetta Miller, and I can't wait for you to unpack this topic alongside us. I first came across Shavetta's work from an Edutopia post. I've guest blogged for Edutopia periodically for about 9 years now, and I love to explore their resources. They also have one of my favorite newsletters, full of great ideas each week. She had a post on Edutopia all about today's topic, and I reached out and asked her to join in today. You'll hear all about graphic novels, comic strips, activity ideas, and plenty of cross-curricular connections too. So if you are typically working outside of an English language arts classroom or you're not quite supporting English language arts teachers, I still believe that today's episode will give you some ideas that you can take into a variety of different tech-friendly environments. So let's dive into this conversation. I cannot wait for you to listen and hear some of her fantastic ideas. Welcome to the podcast. I am so excited to talk about all things graphic novels today. But before we jump in, would love for you to share a little bit about your work, your role in education. What does your day-to-day look like?
Thanks, Monica. It's great to be here with you. My name is Shavetta Miller, and currently I work at a school district in Oregon as an instructional support TOSA, which means I basically support secondary language arts teachers throughout the district with professional development. And I also support talented and gifted services across the district. Outside of that, though, I'm also the director of curriculum for the nonprofit Reading with Pictures that advocates using visual text really internationally in schools and other venues. And aside from that, I also still consult with school districts across the country and partner with teachers who want to collaborate around using visual text in the classroom and other literacy matters.
Awesome. Well, as I mentioned in the intro, I came across your article for Edutopia and was really excited to dive in and talk about this topic with you. I also have a copy of your book that I was able to dive into before we talk together today. And this idea of graphic novels is one that educators and a bunch of different disciplines, you know, may have come across in different ways. And since we're talking about graphic novels today, can you help just unpack that term for us? What exactly is a graphic novel?
Sure. So I like to use the term graphic novel or comic strip or visual text or visual narrative, pretty much interchangeably. I don't see a hierarchy with those terms and different forms of the medium. So basically what we're talking about is telling a narrative using sequential art, a combination of words and pictures to tell a story that isn't necessarily fiction, to convey information or tell a narrative, but it's really that nature of it being a combination of words and pictures. That's not what you would see in, for example, a child's picture book, but where the relationship is really interdependent, not where the words basically describe the pictures, like a caption of a photograph in a newspaper, but this interdependency of the words and pictures is key. And it's also common to use as a defining characteristic that it's sequential art. So there's this intentional order to how the words and pictures progress.
Nice. And, you know, I really appreciate as you're framing that for us, that you're illustrating or kind of emphasizing the piece about it not necessarily being a hierarchy when we use some of these terms interchangeably, because I know I do too, when talking with educators about a comic strip being kind of the shorter form, but also following that sequence. So I really just appreciate you giving us some of those other vocabulary words to really, really talk about this. So, you know, how did you get started using graphic novels with students?
Well, I was a language arts high school teacher in New York City public schools, and we were required to teach a memoir in 11th grade world literature. That was the time when Persepolis by Marjan Satrapi had just been adapted into a movie. So it was on everyone's radar, the students, the teachers. We had ordered a bunch of copies, so we had the text available in the storage room, which was a hurdle that you would have had to jump over otherwise. And I thought it would inspire my diverse community of students there at that school to reflect on their own adolescence the way Satrapi does in Persepolis, and how they were forming their own identities and really learn from each other's diverse experiences doing the same. At the time, I thought it would be an opportunity for us all to learn something together about an unfamiliar form, because it was my first time with a graphic novel, teaching it, reading it. And it actually turned out that when students created their own mini graphic memoirs using Persepolis as a mentor text, I discovered a lot of unforeseen, surprising benefits, like how students were able to use the form to actually narrate really difficult stories they had never told before, orally or in writing or in any form, and how really it was the anonymity of the medium and the empathy that it generates in its readers that allowed them to confront challenging, sometimes even traumatic experiences. And really how reading these stories would positively impact my relationship to certain students and ultimately my teaching.
Yeah. And, you know, I really, really like how you said that it was like almost a co-learning experience, right? Like it was your first time diving into this medium. It was your students' first time diving into this medium, and that opportunity for them to explore it as readers and as writers, writer creators at the same time. And I didn't know that you taught in New York City public schools. I taught in District 3 for almost 7 years in New York City. Which borough were you in, if you don't mind me asking?
Yeah, I taught in the South Bronx and then in Brooklyn. Yeah.
Very cool. Yeah. I knew, you know, and we had talked even before we hit record about you being on the West Coast now, but I'm still today in pretty snowy New York City, right outside of New York City, but in this chilly weather. Not that I'm sure it's not cold by where you are too. Yeah. But yeah, as we, you know, we're thinking about the pieces that it really, you know, all the things it really takes for students to create their own graphic novels or their own comics, their own comic strips. You know, you alluded to it when we were, you know, when I asked you how you got started, but this is something that really requires some heavy lifting for students. It's not just a fluffy thing by any means, right? So listeners are probably familiar with the term higher level thinking, but can you help unpack this for us? And what does it look like in action when we ask that of a group of students?
Yeah, well, higher level thinking really means that the cognitive demands we're putting on ourselves are high. So what that means to me is that we're engaging in higher level thinking when we're seeking to understand the complexity of things, not really looking for a solution, an expedient solution or answer to feel satisfied. It really involves feeling a little unsettled and not having closure, really the idea of resisting closure, seeking to really understand that what we're learning or discussing or reading about is complex, and that we're avoiding just answering it as the end point, and that even when we arrive at answers, that we're seeking to complicate those by engaging in additional reading or widening the perspective or crossing over into other domains and subject areas to learn really how deep this is and how connected it is and how complicated it is. And in practice, I think that looks like forming a lot of questions, arriving at answers, and then questioning those answers after taking in new perspectives through conversation or debate or collaborative work. So something that a higher level thinking task really would demand conversation and collaboration, I think, inherently, to explore ideas, test theories, and seek perspectives. It's definitely something that would take time. It's open-ended, has more than one solution pathway. Mm-hmm. Those are some examples.
Yeah. And so many of those pieces really do require students to work together, right? Or collaborate with a common mission or ask for feedback, right? Throughout that whole process. And so your book, Hacking Graphic Novels, goes into this, of course, but what type of activities lend themselves well to promoting both this higher order thinking piece and using, you know, graphic novels to make it happen?
Yes, I'd love to talk about some of those. There's so many.
Yeah.
So first, I want to remind listeners about this. The comics form inherently lends itself to that kind of higher level thinking because we have intentional gaps already in place in a sequential narrative, sequential art, visual text. So we in the industry kind of uses the word gutters to describe those blank spaces between frames or panels in a comic or graphic novel text. And those gutters, those blank spaces, are actually where a lot of action or internal shifts are taking place in a text or story. And each reader who comes to that page or that text is actually filling in those gaps, sometimes unintentionally and sometimes with a lot of cognitive effort, based on their own point of view, their own interpretations of the visuals and text they've already encountered in that story. And also with visual icons and symbols and representations, it's important to remember too that we don't all interpret them in the same ways, the way that maybe one word is often, you know, the meaning is universally understood from a word. But with an image, it's been shown through research again and again that we don't, even some of the most common icons, like two dots with a semicircle representing a smiley face, we might think that actually not all people interpret that the same way. And so if a text has so many visuals working in interesting ways with the words, with the text, then it follows that the readers are going to be interpreting that very differently. So because of all that ambiguity, reading comics is inherently a collaborative experience. When we discuss with others what we see and think is happening, we're actually reminded of all of the things we overlooked, and we start to question what we actually did see. Mm-hmm. And that compels us to really look again at the page and again. And it reminds us of the possibilities of what things can mean, what stories can say, and how different people think. So some activities that stimulate that kind of discovery with visual text are, here some examples would be having students really take isolated panels of a comic or a graphic novel that's already been written or composed, and just taking those panels and trying to co-construct the narrative that they hadn't seen before originally, and they have to negotiate, you know, what they think the correct quote unquote sequence would be by making inferences from the details and the text and the pictures. And then there are even some gamified versions of this as well. Another idea, a common idea, is that you could give students a strip or a page from a graphic novel and just erase all of the words and only show the pictures and have students individually think about what words would go in those panels and then have them trade with a partner, with a small group, and then even with the whole class and just see guaranteed the variety of ways and stories that students were able to tell with their different interpretations of how those visuals were working. And then vice versa, you know, giving them the pictures and or giving them the words without the images and have them kind of sketch or imagine what those pictures would be. And it also another one that we see in, a lot in language arts classes is taking a story maybe that they're studying or a nonfiction text or even a film and trying to adapt that into, you know, even giving them a boundary like 6-panel comic or a 2-page mini graphic novel or even just a 3-panel comic strip and just seeing all the different choices that students are making, what significant moments they picked up on from that original text to choose to adapt and all of the choices they're just making to translate that other text into this form really is a great way to show just the multiplicity of interpretations and to complicate what maybe they would have otherwise seen as a story with a very clear theme or a nonfiction text with a very clear, certain conclusion.
Yeah. And, you know, even as you're talking about these pieces, which all really ask that heavy lifting from students, right? To think deeply about what is in front of them. It also reminds me so much of close reading strategies and having kids zoom in and kind of talk about all the different things that they might see within a piece of text. So I love that. And I love just the emphasis there that you shared about the co-creation and having conversations around all of these pieces that I think are so crucial, especially when students are introduced to a medium that might not be in their wheelhouse or something that they've had experience with, you know, in the past. And I know there's lots of great social studies examples too, or, you know, historical fiction pieces that fall into, you know, this category of graphic novels for students, you know, as consumers. And, you know, as we think a little bit about a technology connection or, you know, how this connects to some things within the ed tech space, I know I've been pretty impressed with what Canva has in terms of their different kind of features and different panels and different templates for creating all sorts of comic strips. I know Book Creator, I've done a lot of work with their team. They have some of the comics and different panels and different things connected to even our conversation today. But do you find that students have a preference on reading graphic novels in digital or paperback formats? What are you noticing from that consumer side of things and maybe even that creation side of things?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. When I thought about that earlier, I was like, oh, I want to investigate that more and really pay more attention to that in classrooms and in my own family with my comics readers. And what I can say for now that I've noticed when I reflected on that more is with comics specifically, the digital format is really appealing because it gives expedient access to more and more comics, right? So places like Library Pass and Comics Plus and other sort of library type databases give readers who tend to really consume comics and graphic novels at a fast pace, which is really common. And I'm not saying is a bad thing. I know I've been talking a lot about really slowly and methodically engaging with them, but I think that comes as a second, third read through it. And certainly that first blast through it is important and valuable. And so I found definitely that students and just everyone really likes that what the digital format allows is just access to more and more because you are kind of consuming it quite quickly. But it's in those subsequent reads because we do always come back to those comics and graphic novels. I mean, even just think of a Calvin and Hobbes,
right?
Anthologies like printed and published or I'm thinking of Baby Blues or any, you know, even Garfield, Peanuts, all of those anthologies are just ubiquitous because we want to come back to those strips again and again and look at them again. Students who were obsessed with Raina Telgemeier's books, Drama and Guts and Sisters, you know, they don't just read it once and forget it. They want to come back and look at it and engage with it again. And in that way, I found that the paper format invites more examination. We can just easily hold many pages in front of us at once. And like, I feel like you can really see the page you just turned away from more easily in a paper format than when you're swiping away from it in a tablet. And we're just more likely to use our fingers to really point out or trace or touch different details in the panels and corners. You know, we hold the book up closer to us to really study, you know, what's in the background here, or what is that expression on Charlie Brown's face? Or, you know, we're compelled to, we more likely would dog ear a page than just sort of click the digital bookmark, make a note, stare at the cover, you know, sit with it, toss it to the side of us on the couch and look at it again without really meaning to, whereas in a tablet, you'd actually have to unlock your screen and open that back up to look at that cover. So I think it's that paper format for subsequent reads that really lends itself to that examination that these visual texts really demand.
That's such a great point about the visual component, because, you know, as a reader of an ebook, right, you might swipe back and say, wait, what did they say? Or what character, right? Or you might do some rereading just the way you would of a novel. But here, just as you said, you know, I would imagine that flip back, right? Look back at that picture, that quick reference, right? To have that visual connection in a paperback, hold it in your hand type of format. I absolutely see why that might be something a student would lean towards, right? Instead of maybe they do consume a lot of ebooks for novels or other types of text. But in this case, I could definitely see the value of having, or their, I should say, why they might want to have that kind of physical copy in their hand. And I mentioned, you know, your book earlier already. So you've got your book that came out all about this topic that came out last year, Hacking Graphic Novels, 8 Ways to Teach Higher Level Thinking with Comics and Visual Storytelling. And I was hoping we could talk a bit about Hack 4, and I kind of alluded to it already on the creation side of things, right? Specifically with the digital tools. Do you have any favorite creativity tools that students could use on a mobile device, on a tablet or a Chromebook?
Yeah, well, you mentioned Canva, and I'm a big fan of that as well. But the reason I really like Canva is, if I am going to use digital tools, is that it allows for flexibility as opposed to offering students so much in the way of templates and design options and, you know, right-click, insert this, and all these images and avatars they can choose from, which I found more common in other and other tools, like, for example, Pixin, you know, if you go to their site, is they really push the idea that this is easy, you know, it's so easy to create a comic. You can do it right away. And you know, the things that we've been talking about are sort of resisting that idea of easy, and it really is cognitively demanding work to make all of these choices about how you're going to represent an idea, an emotion, a scene, how you're going to take maybe a battle during World War II and just represent it in 3 panels. Right. What size are you going to make those? Are they going to all be the same? Are they going to be round? Are they going to be long? Are they, what perspective? Bird's eye? Are you going to come in from the back? Is it going to be one of those horror movie perspectives? You know, all of these choices have implications and significance. And so I would just be wary of any tool that over provides a structure, a template, or students are limited in ways where they are using pre-created or drawn visuals. And what you know, and I think that can be really intense, just thinking about what your purpose is with the learning task. Those tools can be very useful to get students started.
Right.
But I would see value in sort of moving away from that as they become more fluid and confident and willing to experiment and engage with their own choices, and really just have them think about, even when they are using the provided templates and images, really pausing to think about their impact. Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm going to use this template. Why am I choosing this one as opposed to that one? What kind of story would that one tell versus this one? Or I'm going to use these avatars, and what, why, you know, how would I explain that the character in this novel would look like this versus that? So I think the value is in there, and we really don't want to lose that when we go for easy.
Mm-hmm. That's such a great point, because, you know, there's great things about having some of that content, but there's also, right, that might be the entryway to really go deeper, to have really thoughtful conversations around your why or how you chose something over something else. And I just love that, especially for facilitating conversations with peer feedback and teacher feedback, right, as you're diving into all of this and really supporting student creators. So, you know, this has just been so fantastic to help listeners wrap their head around this idea of graphic novels and comic strips and going deeper and really supporting that higher level of thinking. Can you let us know where can listeners connect with you? I'll put links and all those good things in the show notes, but where can they learn more about your work?
Yes, I would love to hear from listeners. I'm always looking to collaborate with other teachers or folks interested in using visual text with students or for themselves. So yeah, I think you can reach me really easily through Twitter. I'm at Shavetta Miller on Twitter. I also have a website with a contact form, ShavettaMiller.com. You can send me an email through there. Always happy to hear what people are doing in their classrooms and interested in collaborating in lots of different ways.
Well, thank you, Shavetta, so much for joining in on the podcast today. It's been so wonderful to chat with you.
Thanks, Monica.
So after this conversation, my wheels in my head, I guess, are definitely spinning. There's a lot of things I know I want to dive into a little bit more deeply, but let's finish up this episode like we always do with a couple quick things to consider. First, introduce students to graphic novels and comics as consumers. Next, connect to critical thinking and close reading strategies. Then, give students an opportunity to talk about what they're reading. Finally, provide a chance for students to create their own comic strips. Remember, you can find the show notes and the full list of resources from this episode, including a link to Shavetta's new book and all the ways to connect with her on classtechtips.com/podcast. Just look for episode 152 and you'll see all of the links at the bottom of the corresponding blog post. A big thank you to our sponsor for this episode, Lenovo EDU, the free online student community of Lenovo. This free platform lets you connect with education experts and find videos and articles on educational content. You can sign up for free at education.lenovo.com for special discounts, laptop giveaways, free classes, scholarships, and you'll even find some exclusive blog posts I put together for them too. Thank you for tuning in to today's episode. If you're listening to this podcast on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or another favorite app, don't forget to hit the follow button. When you follow along with the podcast, each new episode will download for you automatically so you don't miss a thing. And if you have a moment today and are feeling extra helpful, please leave a 5-star rating or a short review for the podcast. It helps other educators find this podcast when they're searching for topics like EdTech in their podcast app. If you're listening on Spotify, the rating option is new this year. So if you haven't looked for it, you can find the stars right underneath the episode title and you can tap and leave a rating there as well. Have a great week and check back on Tuesday morning for next week's new episode.